This episode is an exclusive insight into the views of the Elgium investment team on what's happening in markets and what this means for investors. This podcast is intended for investment professionals, and if you're enjoying Elgium Talks, why not subscribe in your Apple Podcasts or Spotify app and never miss another episode.
Hello and welcome to this CIO Market Update from Elgium. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Howie Lee, Head of ETFs, and Fadi Zaher, Head of Index Solutions. A quick housekeeping note before we get started. We're going to move this call to a monthly basis going forward, so expect to hear from Sonia and her expert panel next time in early August. Now, as we hold our first update of H2, risk assets remain relatively buoyant, even though concerns over the pandemic, the economy, and geopolitics persist, and news on the fiscal front continues to slow. On that note, Sonia, as always, could you please kick off the call by walking us through the state of financial markets and the health of the global economy?
Absolutely, with great pleasure. Good morning, everyone. As always, I hope you're joining us healthy and safe. And it's clearly been another very eventful 2 weeks. So let me start off, as usual, with a few thoughts on the virus, because it's very clear that after a relatively calm period where we've had more news flow on lifting restrictions, we've squarely moved back in worrying a lot about second waves and obviously looking at emerging markets that clearly still is in the first wave. We're looking with great concern to countries like Brazil, where it seems that the infection rates are still going up on a daily basis. You see this very clearly on the slide right in front of you now, that obviously the emerging market wave is still very much in its first inning. But you see very worryingly that the US, so the slightly lighter blue area underneath, is worryingly moving up quite dramatically. But we are hearing about second waves across a number of countries. So Melbourne, for example, in Australia, is moving into its second lockdown. Tokyo was in the headlines this morning with a worrying increase in new cases. And obviously here in the UK, we know that Leicester has been put into a temporary local lockdown as well. There's other worrying news this morning, that Oxfam has warned that, in fact, across some emerging markets, there might be more people dying from hunger, actually, than from the disease, and that this might reach actually more than 12,000 a day. They have published a list of 10 countries where they feel this could be a real severe issue. And as we've discussed in the past, we were always worried that in particular some emerging markets are faced with a real dilemma in terms of putting lockdown measures in place, given the circumstances, and that in fact that the consequences of lockdown might be more severe than the disease itself. Elsewhere, Brazil obviously has been in the headlines for a number of weeks now, but very much this week because President Bolsonaro has been tested positive and has obviously isolated himself and is taking this very controversial malaria drug and has been actually seen putting it on social media, which has led to a dramatic increase of demand for that drug in Brazil. So with that in mind, very clearly, you can imagine that our discussion internally has moved towards an understanding of how the second wave might impact, you know, our economic forecast. And the U.S., not surprisingly in particular, is worrying us a lot. So you see here on the next page right in front of you that obviously the news that we've received from California, Florida, and Texas in particular are very worrying, and we're looking to see how this is now leading to either renewed lockdown measures. So far, they have been partially implemented. So for the time being, it's mostly linked to closing bars, restaurants, and obviously public gatherings. But it will be very interesting to see, given that we're approaching the hotter period of the presidential election, on how this will unfold. Interestingly as well, and we have debated this at length, is whether, you know, because what we haven't seen so far is an increase in the death rate, and though hospitalization rates suggest that we might see definitely an increase in the death rate in the U.S., And that obviously will lead potentially to further lockdown. And I will come to the economic implication in a minute. But very much this is what we have feared might happen. And it very much comes down to how the US will react to this and how we then have to adjust our economic forecast. As you know, in terms of the kind of final solution for the pandemic, we've always said that obviously a vaccination, although there have been very encouraging headlines over the last couple of weeks, it's very clear that making a vaccine globally available is a very long undertaking. And although there seem to be a few front runners, we are nowhere near a production level yet. And as such, these will remain positive headlines for the time being, and we will have to wait and see. But it's very clear, and again, there were a number of headlines over the last 2 weeks, that governments very clearly would like to lock in, obviously, preferred, you know, delivery times and delivery slots from these producers. Looking at the economic update and clearly tying the developments around the global virus development into our economic forecast, then you will recall that initially the numbers we have been seeing actually have shown a very distinct V-shape. So the initial reaction of the economy towards the opening has been very positive. And in fact, it looked like that we are moving more towards scenario one rather than scenario two, i.e. a successful opening of the economy has led to a revitalization, and the short-term indicators actually, in fact, have been positive. Yet, if you think about the U.S. in particular and the latest virus developments, then obviously you can imagine we're watching very carefully for any signs that this green line, i.e. our growth tracker, is indeed flattening. And this data pack here is from the 9th of June, but we have actually received this morning an update on this chart. And indeed, we are seeing first signs of flattening in the short-term indicators, clearly linked to the fact that regional lockdown measures will have to be implemented again. And we would not be surprised, depending on how severe those lockdown measures will be, to see a slight retracement, i.e. moving more towards our second scenario rather than the first one. But unfortunately, at this point, we can only look at the indicators as they come in, because it's not clear yet, given the U.S. is not applying a uniform lockdown principled approach across the U.S., and it will depend on state governments to implement those measures. Now, unemployment is one we have touched upon a number of times in the past, and I think at this point here, I would like to refer to what Rishi Sunak told us yesterday in the UK with his mini-budget, but it's the same principle that apply here. As you know, we still have more than 9 million people in furlough schemes in the US, more than 12 million in Germany, and there's more than 20 million people still in the United States that receive benefits in the form of the Paycheck Protection Scheme. So we haven't seen the full impact on unemployment yet, and hence it's not surprising that the mini-budget of Rishi Sunak yesterday very squarely focused on the labor market, and that most measures seem more like an extension to the current furlough scheme and very clearly aim to encourage companies to employ workers that are currently in a furlough scheme. That shows you that the government is very worried of what we have called here the so-called reallocation shock, i.e. you will see that those people that, for example, have worked in the travel and leisure industry might not go straight back into their old jobs, because this is an industry that will probably come back and come out of this crisis in a very different shape. And as such, obviously, the chances that there will be a number of people that will remain unemployed post the crisis is relatively high, and hence, not surprisingly, a focus on those areas. And likewise, in the mini budget yesterday, you've seen targeted measures for the hospitality sector in particular to dampen that impact. I would not be surprised to see similar measures from the US as well. We are expecting further debates on fiscal support from the US, simply because they do understand that although the initial lifting of restrictions has led to the right economic reaction function, but that obviously longer-term scaring is still a very real possibility, in particular if some of the states will have to go back down into lockdown and obviously will hence see their economic activity drop again. Now, in the context of fiscal stimulus, as just discussed, we have seen a number of additional measures already announced. So what you see here is still the first round of measures that was announced right in the middle of the pandemic. But as just said, we have now seen the UK come back. We do expect the US come back. And depending on whether there will be more widespread lockdown measures necessary in other countries, we do expect governments to react accordingly. Now, when it comes to the emerging markets, it's clear that there has not been too much public support yet, neither from central banks nor from governments, and hence there is still room for both to react, and in particular central banks, to obviously cut rates and to provide quantitative easing. As you know, it's not always straightforward to move all emerging markets in one basket, and as such, obviously, as you can see there on the left, the headroom for most of these countries is very different, but I think overall we haven't seen pronounced measures yet, but depending on how the virus will develop there, we would imagine to see more from these countries as well. Now, I will probably skip over the Brexit slide, although you will not be surprised that in terms of the topic in itself, it has squarely moved back up on the agenda. But I would like to really focus now on how the market has reacted. Now that the first half is behind us, we can obviously take stock, and it's been quite an extraordinary first half with the massive drawdown in March and then followed by an equally strong bounce back throughout April, May, and to some extent June. But as you can see here on the slide, June in particular has more been of a sideways movement, and it seems very clearly that the market is trying to digest on what the next move should look like. And we have had a really good debate this week on, is it enough that central banks and governments have declared their full support for economy and markets, or will indeed a potential second wave and hence lockdown measures create another risk of environment? And it is very interesting because in terms of the valuation levels, we have obviously retraced quite a lot of the initial setback, and it will depend a lot on how companies fare in the second half, in particular in 2021, on how equity markets can develop. And as we've highlighted a number of times, yes, there will be relative winners, but we should not forget that we are back at a level that has quite an optimistic overall scenario for the global economy. And you see this, we've tried to show you the expectation here in terms of the earnings recovery, and you see already that the market most likely sits very much in a scenario one and a backdrop, and hence we have to be very mindful that any kind of setback to that scenario might not be well received by markets. The same is true for the credit universe, and you see here that, again, after the very strong initial reaction to all the central bank support, we are now, you know, stalling above pre-crisis levels. We have highlighted a number of times the downgrade activity and obviously the defaults that we have seen. And again, I think the same what I've just said for the equity market is true for credit, and we would be very selective in terms of our engagement with the market now. You know that we have been very good in terms of timing of the market throughout March, but we have now moved more towards neutral because we believe there is a few areas that we would like to see with greater clarity before we would engage further. Our thematic approach remains, and obviously that's a very good time to hand back to Max and then obviously speak to not only Sadi, but and Howie as well on our approach to thematic investing and factor investing. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that update, Sonia. And let's stay with the theme of markets now. Sadi, looking back at the last 6 months, what's worked well in factor-based investing and what hasn't?
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you very much. And thank you, Sonia, for setting the theme because obviously, the background to what I'll probably say reflects what Sonia mentioned. So basically, the first first half of this year, I would call it the tale of two halves, as Sonia alluded to the outbreak the first quarter. A lot of the risky assets and a lot of the factors actually really suffered from the on the back of the outbreak, but also falling energy prices. And obviously in the second half of that quarter this year, what we saw is that factor strategy, especially the high beta ones, and more broadly also actually made a recovery on the back of the physical and monetary stimulus that policymakers undertook. And it kind of resembled almost what we saw for factors in 2008. But if you actually look at the slide here, which summarizes the performance in the first half, this is the cumulative performance of the various pies and factors. And what you see here is that the grouping of the winners through the first half of this year has actually been, in terms of style, is the growth, then quality, and then momentum. And the laggards were actually low volatility, the size, the smaller companies, and the value. Value gets crushed. The drawdown was almost similar to what we saw in the dot-com boom back in 2000. So, and the interesting observation here is that what you see is that the performance or the grouping that we saw in the first half of this year resembles what we have seen in the past 10 years. And there is an element of surprise to this, although it's a very short-term period to kind of draw a meaningful conclusion on for factor investing. But we know typically, I mean, we have lived in a low interest rate environment, low real economic growth, and that type of environment has always favored and continues to favor growth companies and has also benefited companies with quality characteristics, quality factors, such as profitable companies, stable businesses, businesses with strong governance. But this crisis shuffled the deck a bit, specifically for some factors, and the surprise element, I would say here, Max, is that this is a public health crisis, and it's not similar to what previous crisis, at least economic slowdowns that we have seen. And the surprise element here is the momentum and low volatility, especially for the first half of this year. Momentum typically suffers, and low volatility, which is the defensive factor, benefits when you're actually looking about around the turning point of the market cycle or when you're actually heading into a bear market. And that even happened also, this type of factors behave in this way when volatility spikes in the market. But this time, actually, it didn't happen, even though we said that this is a different crisis, the health crisis that we have seen. I always say, I don't know if you followed me over the years, but I always say that if you actually a low volatility investor, you hunt for rabbits during the Stone Age time rather than hunting for mammoths. But sadly, this time the rabbits were not enough for the hungry bear, so he decided to chase a herd of mammoths. The herd mentality is about the momentum aspect that I'm referring to here. But if you want more details about this analogy, I'm more than happy to take it after. But obviously, unlike previous crises, this obviously the macro reasons doesn't really pinpoint why this conundrum happened for low volatility and momentum, rather than structural things, I would say. And if to understand that, just go back before the outbreak, this kind of end of last year, beginning of January, see what was inside this strategy, the low volatility, low risk strategy. It was actually substantially overweight utilities and real estate, and massively underweight technology and healthcare, specifically those sectors that did pretty well. Okay, that's the low risk. So that's why it didn't really do what it's supposed to be doing from a defensive point of view, although quality as a defensive factor did well. Momentum, on the other hand, was actually overweight technology sector and the consumer staples. So this is obviously these sectors, this part of the market that did pretty well, where you were underweight financials and the healthcare on the momentum. And obviously healthcare was not a massive underweight, but the financials was an underweight. So therefore, it gets that push.
Well, that's really a really interesting overview, Fadi. And I am familiar with your thoughts about mammoths and rabbits. I would just add that your comments now prompt a question that's on many investors' lips, which is, looking ahead, is now finally the time for value to shine?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question. And I would just say, when it comes to value, we know that the macro environment over the decades and even now hasn't really been beneficial for value investors. But I would say the performance of value in itself is actually driven by two things, and the reason for that is the structural definition of value. I mean, value, a lot of academics looks at value based on the price to book, and that's a well-recognized academic definition of value. But also the academics themselves starting to revisit that definition because the book value doesn't capture everything that in terms of assets of the company, such as intangible assets. That's the first thing. The other thing is that the sector, the value has itself been kind of had an overweight to financials and underweight technology. And we know that, again, in a low interest rate environment, that's not going to help the banks because banks rely on a higher level of interest rate based on the business models, but also the risk of impairment when you have the low economic growth. And also now you have kind of the massive slowdown, there's obviously fear about the impairment around this asset. So this actually, the definitions of value and also the way the value gets allocated. So I think what we're trying to what we're seeing now is that more people are revisiting this definition, and I think we're revising the definition of value and adding in actually more complementary elements that capture that intangible, such as research and development, into the value of the valuation of the company, and even like some of the operational expenses, CapEx, take that into account as a part of the valuation. I think you could see that value go head to head with growth over a longer period of time, but in the short term, I don't think this is going to be different from what we have seen in global financial crisis or even the dot-com boom because value is one of the factors that tends to actually jump on the recovery. So whether it's time, maybe, yes.
Right, well, thank you for that insight, Sadi. And let's move to Howie now. Howie, last time you were on the call, you mentioned that 7 of our 8 investment themes were outperforming. How have they continued to fare?
Hi, Max. It's a great question, actually, and I'm glad to be back to be able to highlight where these portfolios have performed and how these themes have fared. Glad to say that 7 of the 8 themes continue indeed to do well and has indeed continued to outperform the MSCI world. I think we've always said that long-term themes have been positioned for growth, especially those that focus on technological drivers and how we consume energy and resources. Of course, the demographics acts as a lever for demand, and the disruption that we've seen from the coronavirus and the global lockdown has certainly changed the way that we live and work. And it's really this disruption, this continued disruption over the past 3 months that has led to acceleration of many of these themes. It's led us all to live in a much more connected digital world, and with kind of more tech-focused solutions coming to fore, these are the themes that are really benefiting from it. If you take a look at the slide that's in front of you, you know, what you can clearly see is that, you know, across all the different themes, you know, there are certain portfolios that are actually outshining some of the others, especially when you look at a global kind of equities portfolio benchmark. I would say if we look at both pharmaceutical breakthroughs and cybersecurity, they've certainly been the most resilient to draw down and also managed to provide outperformance as the recovery took place through April, May, and June as well. And what's interesting, you know, this slide shows figures up until the end of June. And even in the first week of July, i.e. last week, we've seen some of these themes continue to climb. And it's really important to really appreciate why these portfolios or these themes are doing what they're doing versus the global equity benchmark. What I would say is that, you know, one of the 8th theme, if you will, which is clean water, that has closer performance to MSCI World or global equities portfolio, and that's because it has more engineering companies and utility companies, rather a heavy tilt towards some of the big tech companies that have indeed pulled up the global benchmarks. Perhaps it might be a good chance also to look specifically at, you know, a few of these themes in more detail. And if we take a look at the next slide, what we'll be able to talk about is how cybersecurity remains a major topic for most companies and the public. We often get questions as to, wow, technology seems to be really doing well over the last 6 months. But it's important to see that actually it's not all companies in the technological sector. There are certain ones which have been more impacted by the coronavirus and those that have been least impacted by the coronavirus. And if we look at the right-hand side of this slide, you'll see things that are connected to security software, gaming software, interestingly, as well as cloud services. These have been least impacted during this time. If we even take a look at the following slide, you know, we're then looking at essentially some logistics companies that have essentially benefited from the increased use of e-commerce. And the fact that more and more of us are now shopping online, expecting things to be delivered to our house because we simply just cannot get out, it's not surprising to see that e-commerce last mile, you know, according to our experts that we work with at Transport Intelligence, these will be in the greatest demand after coronavirus. And that's followed by e-fulfillment, i.e. in the warehouse, and again, e-commerce, on-demand, instant delivery. And we see how companies are essentially responding to this, and they will more and more likely outsource logistical functions to external providers rather than try to run, let's say, a retail company run logistics themselves. And finally, I do want to shine a light on in the healthcare industry as well. We take a look at the next slide and just really just comment on some of the, I suppose, the contraction and also the expansion of the different sectors. And you'll see here that essentially pharmaceuticals and biotech have been going through, unsurprisingly, a period of expansion during this time. And I think a lot of this, when we take a look at the themes that we follow, healthcare breakthrough shift to preventative medicine, AI-powered diagnostics, and remote monitoring through connected devices, this is actually being accelerated again by coronavirus and the fact that some of us are still living in some sort of semi-lockdown state.
Well, thanks for that, Howie. I'm conscious of the time, so what I'm going to do now is just ask a couple of very quick-fire questions with 30-second answers if possible. So one for you, which is looking ahead to the second half of the year, where do you see opportunities for ETF investors?
Yeah, sure. For us, we see, again, on the long-term themes, these are positioned to grow in the longer term and also highlight the fact that there are opportunities or are being accelerated by the current situation. So long-term focus on themes, it remains important for investors in ETFs and other portfolios. But also, I think what's really interesting about you know, where investors want to put their money is around sustainable investments in ESG, of course. And that's across both equities and fixed income. And I think that is going to be a very interesting space over the next kind of 12 to 18 months.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thanks for that. Fadi, this is a question from one of our clients, particularly relevant right now. Do you think in recent events, such as the pandemic and anti-racism protests, are likely to impact how ESG factors are measured, monitored, and implemented within index construction?
Thank you, Max. It's a very good question. I don't think anything has changed because the social aspect has always been part of the ESG, and it's a central part. We started like 3 years ago when we did our ESG scoring, and we had themes that we thought are important, and new themes are coming in. We have social rights, we have the gender diversity, where we have data. Often the other things related to behaviors of companies can be also complemented with engagement, where we engage with companies. But I think what this will do is maybe this encourage companies to be more transparent and more disclosure, so you can start to collect more information about the social aspects, how companies are doing things. So yes, it might just accelerate transparency and openness. But in terms of importance of it, it's still important and has always been.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you. And Howie, here's another question from a client about this extraordinary moment, and that is, how have travel restrictions and virtual meetings rather than face-to-face meetings affected your ability to engage with companies?
Do you know what, Max? The interesting thing is our experience has been that companies are more willing to engage, especially through things like Zoom or MS Teams. And I think partially it's because they don't need to travel as much. If we kind of take a look at just over the last month or so, you know, we've been able to connect with CEOs, CFOs at over a dozen companies where we're able to ask them questions as to how their business is doing, where they see any issues, and also what kind of holds out for the long-term future post-coronavirus. And I think that experience of being able to speak to these companies is also reflected by the work that our expert partners are doing. They too have been able to connect very intensely with these companies to understand better. And for example, you know, we were able to do a webinar with Transport Intelligence to go through and share views of, you know, lockdown, acceleration of growth in this sector, and the continued opportunity, you know, for logistics firms. We even had a cybersecurity company, their CEO, join us for a webinar as well. So we found the engagement actually very high, and we continue to expect that to be the case over the rest of the year.
Well, that's fascinating. Sonia, would you like to weigh in on this last question from a pan-Elgin perspective in terms of how we engage with the companies in which we invest? And is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish up this morning?
No, absolutely. Thank you. And I can mostly echo what Howie just said, because obviously it's not only us that had to adjust to the new normal, and obviously the use of technology, use of video, and hence the lack of face-to-face interaction. And it's really amazing how fast we have been able to adjust, and that obviously rather than inviting a company to come in and talk to us, you will organize a Zoom call or a WebEx call to do exactly the same interaction. And so far, it has been, you know, a very pleasant experience. And I think it's been really good to see that the level of engagement clearly hasn't dropped. And as such, you know, of course, over time, we would prefer to have face-to-face and one-on-one meetings. But I think in the interim, this will be a very different mix in the future, because at least it gives you a lot more flexibility if you think about engaging with companies in Asia or the U.S. to use video technology rather than conference calls. I think there will be a big step away from that, and I think that will allow us to think about how and when we can engage with companies. Although I personally would hope that face-to-face will still play a very important role when it comes to company engagement. And I think just to finish off, it's clearly been an extraordinary first half, and I guess we have to prepare ourselves that the second half will be equally interesting, and that over the summer in particular, the U.S. election and the U.S. you know, virus and economic developments will to a large part determine you know, the direction of travel in markets. And I think we have more kind of political or geopolitical events that we believe will be more prominent in the second half. I know that I haven't really touched on Brexit, but clearly those discussions will be more prominent over the summer and into the autumn. And likewise, the China-US relationship, I'm sure, will heat up throughout the presidential campaign. So there's a lot to watch out for, and this is why we felt today it is prudent to highlight the valuation levels and obviously how much of the good support news that central banks and governments are providing is already priced in. And hence, obviously, we have to be mindful to try and understand how market participants will react to potentially more negative news from the economic front and whether additional fiscal stimulus will be sufficient to keep markets where they are. Thematic investing, we believe, is a big part of that conundrum and can help at least to navigate some inevitable volatility going forward. So we will continue, obviously, our approach and keep you updated on how we think about this. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Sonia. That's a great point on which to end this week's call. I'd like to thank you, Howie, and Fadi for your time today. And I'd like to thank our clients for logging in. As ever, our podcast listeners can find a link to the slides in this episode's show notes. See you all again next time in early August.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.